available in more homes than the Pac-12 Network, we are the Podcast of Champions. Fight! I'm David Woods from Bruin Report Online.
And here he goes, Miles Jack.
And I'm Ryan Abraham from USCFootball.com.
Liner going to try to sneak it ahead. Touchdown, SC!
We are the Podcast of Champions.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Podcast of Champions. I'm David Woods from Bruin Report Online, the UCLA site on the 247 Sports Network.
And this is Ryan Abraham with USCFootball.com, the USC site on the 247 Sports Network. And we are the Podcast of Champions, talking Pac-12 football, now coming at you each and every week. We're on a pretty good roll, Dave. We're gonna keep this going during the offseason. Weekly Podcast of Champions.
I feel like every time you say something like that, you like massively jinx it. And the next week, we're just nowhere to be found. We maybe record on a Friday, and then it's 3 weeks before we record another one. So, again, we're taking it 1 week at a time.
Yeah, I kind of have to make declarations. So this is how my brain works somehow. Like, I'm a sweet tooth addict. I'm a little too heavy right now for my taste. And I'll eat like a bowl of M&Ms for lunch sometimes. You know, it's that kind of stuff. Like I eat like a 12-year-old boy. So I have to declare I can't eat sweets. And once I make that in my head, that declaration, then I haven't eaten sweets for like 2 weeks. But if I'm like, I'll just have a few, then I have no control. So if I declare that we're going to do a show every week, that sets in my mind, okay, we got to do a show every week. So that's just kind of how my brain works.
You're a LeVar Ball speak it into existence type.
Yes.
If you understand that. I've long since surrendered to my compulsions. I can't speak anything into an existence at all, ever, at any given moment.
I'm trying a new one. We're really off the rails. We just started. I was at a Super Bowl party yesterday, and my buddy, who's in really good shape, he does 100 push-ups a day for a year. So that was the challenge, like 100 push-ups a day for a year. And I guess last year he missed it by one day. He got like too drunk or something. And I was like, well, maybe I could do like 30 a day for like a couple weeks and see how that goes. So I've started doing it. I'm like, all right, I'll do that. So we'll see.
Hey, that's something. Challenge yourself. Not bad. I like it.
Yeah, we'll do a little bit. Well, anyway, so we are, you wouldn't know this, but we actually talk about Pac-12 football if this is your first time on the Podcast of Champions. If you would like to check out our website, it's pac12podcast.com. You can find all our old episodes there. You can tweet us at Pac-12Podcast. Our email is Pac-12Podcast@gmail.com. That's through our friends at Google. And voicemail is the number 641-715-3900, extension 734-972. Please leave us a voicemail. We got a couple emails this week, which we're going to get to later, Dave, because we got some exciting stuff coming on. We're following through on promises.
I know, for the first time ever, it feels like. So last week, if you tuned in, we began a series that was loaned out to us by our friend Hithliday Almond, one of our longtime listeners, who wanted us to basically break down kind of the infrastructure of each Pac-12 school, what they kind of bring to the table in terms of finances, in terms of institutional buy-in, all of that good stuff. And last week, since they're the two programs we know best, we talked USC and UCLA, and this week we're going to talk the Arizona schools.
Yeah, we got our buddy Chris Cartman from Some Devil Source. He does an amazing job over there covering the Sun Devils. And Jason Shear, really on top of everything Arizona. Now, he talks a lot of basketball. Both these guys talk a lot of basketball, so we can't let them talk any hoops, Dave. But we got to keep them to football. But Jason Shear from Wildcat Authority, so – we'll have the Arizona schools covered. I think we actually have a couple of tweets. People tweeted in a couple questions about the Arizona schools. So it'll be all in on the desert schools today.
For sure.
Awesome. Well, I think we're going to get to our first interview, Dave. Does that sound good to you?
Yeah, let's jump in. So are we, we're starting with Chris Cartman from Sun Devil Source.
Okay, so we do have on the line our buddy, our pal, Chris Cartman. You can follow him on Twitter at Chris Cartman, K-A-R-P-M-A-N. He is the publisher of sundevilsource.com, part of the 24/7 Sports Network. He's a Heisman voter. It's the largest ASU sports community out there. He does a great job covering the Arizona State Sun Devils, and we appreciate him taking out some time, as he mentioned when we got him on the call, 2 days before signing day. So we're asking a lot from a publisher of a site to come on, do this, our little show 2 days before signing day. But thanks, Chris, for coming on, and welcome to the show.
Hey, my pleasure. Always going to make time for you. Yeah, there's a lot going on, but it's also a good time to have a conversation about football.
Yeah, especially with coaching change at ASU, kind of this is good for every Pac-12 school, but also, you know, kind of reset the idea of what the ASU job is and the structural factors there. So just to recap for everybody out there, this is a little series from our, as I said up top, from Hithloday Almond, one of our listeners, examining the structural factors of the Pac-12 programs. And he wrote to us saying, the following is my list of questions, which I think can be fairly asked of every school to measure their baseline strengths and weaknesses. And again, I'm trying to avoid answers which rely on a snapshot of current coaches and players. So let's just kind of jump right in to start out with. His first section is touching on resources. Would you say that ASU has the money to kind of meet its program goals?
Well, yes and no. I would say that ASU's done a pretty good job of staying connected to the rest of the Pac-12 in that regard in recent years, and that's primarily because of the stadium district, which has enabled the overhaul of Sun Devil Stadium, the construction of new football facilities, and everything associated with that, plus, of course, the media rights distribution in the Pac-12. The reason that I would say no is because the Pac-12 is still behind in that area, especially as it relates to the SEC. And I see some potentially systemic problems coming into the forefront as a result of that. You look at this year, the coaching changes in the Pac-12, Oregon State, ASU, Arizona, all are paying their assistant coaches, I mean, their head coaches, $2 million or less to start out. And in some cases, that rises pretty significantly to over $3 million, $3.5 million over the term of the deal. But compare that to what's taking place in other parts of the country, where you actually now have some of the top coordinators making $2 million a year and getting four-year deals, whereas like the Arizona Board of Regents only allows you to have a two-year contract for your coordinators and one-year contracts for the rest of your assistant coaches. So I see a growing disparity between the haves and the have-nots at the major conference level, particularly the SEC compared to the Pac-12, that are going to be problematic and probably additionally so in years to come. And I don't know how that gets resolved. The that are associated with that. But ASU particularly is going to see a good jump in the coming years to its athletics revenue as a result of the stadium district. Once it matures in the next 6 to 8 years, that'll probably give it a boost of 20% to 30% in its overall operating budget. And I don't know that they're going to allocate all that money the way that I would allocate it, which would be primarily to football. But because I think football is the grass, the water that keeps all your grass green in the rest of your athletic department, right? So as opposed to spending money on hockey and new sports and sports that are that lose money, expansion of athletic department officials and salaries and things that I don't think actually give you a good return on your investment. I think ASU is pretty well positioned and hanging in there as a borderline top 30 or maybe even top 25 revenue program nationally. But I see some things that are good about that and some things that aren't good about that.
There was it was $100 million. They passed the $100 million level, right, for the first time? Arizona State did?
Right. So ASU basically had stadium project, including the football facility, that's going to end up being $130 odd million. And then just in the last couple of weeks, they approved a project that's going to essentially reconfigure Wells Fargo Arena, the basketball arena, and then build another 5,000 seat arena that's going to be tethered to Wells Fargo. And that whole project is going to be also a nine figure kind of a, I forgot the number off the top of my head, but also over $100 million. So there's a lot of capital project improvements that, that will give ASU, as good a facilities probably as anybody in the league other than like Oregon, right? Cause Oregon's got Ferrari leather sofas and, you know, all this other stuff that is like almost unnecessary. But, I, you know, from what I've seen going into all the schools in the country, I mean, in the Pac-12, I think ASU will be, you know, as good as almost all of them, once it gets these last, couple major projects completed in the next 4 or 5 years.
I guess that's maybe a good follow-up question then, because we're asking in context of program goals, what are those? Like, what are the realistic program goals for ASU football?
Are we talking about, yeah, so this is so interesting because Ray Anderson, when he fired Todd Graham, he basically said, really like straightforward, our goal is to be a top 15 program consistently and to be in the top three of the Pac-12 consistently. And I was like, whoa, like I was like, you know, surprised that he would say something like that, because I don't think that's really all that realistic. You don't really have anybody that's even accomplished that. Certainly not anybody other than USC or maybe Oregon when it was at its pinnacle under Chip Kelly and immediately thereafter. So, but I think what they really want to be able to accomplish is they want to do better in recruiting, and especially in the proximate recruiting hotbed, which is really Southern California. You look at, I think we talked about this when I've been on the podcast previously, but ASU's two Rose Bowl teams, both of them were just loaded with talent from California. And Ray Anderson said, we need to do better in California. This staff has already set out, plotted a course to try to endear themselves to high school coaches in Southern California. They made this huge flurry of activity by sending 6-7 coaches to some of these top schools in Southern California that everybody knows, like Sarah and Oaks Christian. So that's their goal. You know, I think it's going to be hard. I don't know that that's achievable. I think they need to do a much better job of keeping the very best players in Arizona. And ultimately the most realistic thing that they could probably hope for would be to be more of a 8-win, 9-win type of a football team on a more consistent basis, as opposed to having these dips where they'll go for a couple, 2-3 years where they're a borderline bowl type of a team, you know, 6 wins, give or take. And then they'll have these 1 or 2 year spikes where they'll win 9 games, 10 games, and then they'll drop back down. I think realistically, the goal is to elevate their average win total by about a win to a win and a half a season.
One last point on this first point about resources, at least for me, I don't know if Dave, if you have anything else, but the way this is structured, obviously it's a different structure going into it with Herm Edwards, like the more of the NFL, you know, general manager kind of mentality and all of that. Is it set up to kind of utilize resources more efficiently? Do you think just at least the plan are kind of going this way, which is, you know, different than what we've seen in college football most of the way? Is it supposed to kind of utilize the resources you have in a more efficient way?
Yes, that's a big part of it. And essentially what ASU is doing, they're not reinventing the wheel. The idea that this is like going to be some new thing, this new leadership model, and nobody's doing it like this, that's, you know, incorrect. And I don't think ASU did itself any favors with the way it put out that first press release that talked was like, you know, like something you'd see from like Office Space or whatever, right? I think what they really want to do is they want to try to make portable what they've done with student athlete development and academics in terms of the systems and technology and kind of being on the cutting edge of a lot of those things. They want to try to port those things over to football. So Gene Boyle is he was a football player at ASU in the early to mid 90s, originally from Southern California. He was in charge of shaping, overhauling ASU's student athlete academic program. And over a long period of time, ASU went from being really unsuccessful in those areas to being actually quite solid. ASU's been a second to Stanford pretty consistently in some of the key metrics that you would look at, like overall team GPA. They hit 3.0 as a team last spring. The graduation rates, APR numbers, all those things are really robust for ASU right now. And so what Ray Anderson, in speaking with Gene Boyd about a lot of these things, they decided they want to try to take a lot of these systems over to football and see if they can have some success in that regard. And so Boyd has now become a really central figure with ASU football. Unofficially, he's going to be like the general manager of ASU football. And officially, his title is executive a senior associate athletic director. So he's kind of like a right-hand man. He in some ways, of course, he's underneath. You know, and then in other ways, he's like on an equal line. So you would have Ray Anderson underneath Ray Anderson. You would have probably on an organizational chart, Herm Edwards. You would have ASU's senior associate athletic director for football, Tim Cassidy, who's really in charge of the operations, the day-to-day operations of ASU football. And then you would have Gene Boyd. And then a lot of the things underneath them that you would find in every college football program, like who's in charge of your player personnel, who's in charge of your recruiting, who's in charge of your creative, you know, which has become a really big thing in college football, which is primarily your graphic artistry and your video production, the things that really resonate with kids. I think, and then you have your player development side of things, which is like your liaison to your players for all the things that they do and go through and need on a day-to-day basis. Those are like the four areas. And then of course your on-field staff, your GAs, your quality control, et cetera, et cetera. Those things, the latter that I'm speaking of, they fall directly under Herm Edwards, of course, but Gene Boyd was involved in the hiring process for those people as somebody who was in the interviews and all that stuff. And then you have some areas that are going to be falling directly under Gene Boyd and not as much under Herm Edwards, like who's in charge of your creative department. And then the recruiting stuff is, and player personnel stuff would be in concert between Gene Boyd and Herm Edwards. And then of course you have underneath all those people, all of your next level of assistants, and then you would have your student assistants even below that. So that's sort of like the organizational chart, if you will, of what ASU football is going to look like. I don't think it's that different to have at the better programs in the country. And then getting that staffed up and resourced level that you want it to be and having that be executed as efficiently as you would like it to be. That's going to be a process that's probably going to take some time, you know, probably years, not weeks and months. And that's what I think, that's you get the huge differentiations of success. If you go to Alabama or Clemson or Ohio State, it's like a well-oiled machine in these areas with personnel, recruiting, creative, player development, and then all of your on-campus camps and events, and all that stuff is just from one year to the next, they know exactly what their calendar looks like, what they did on this day, how did they make it better the next year on that exact same day. et cetera, et cetera. So that's just kind of an outline of what ASU or any other program would be trying to compete with. And those programs are spending a lot more money. It's a lot of hard capital that's going into those areas versus what an ASU is able to do. That's where I think you have more of a difference between the haves and have-nots. How much money? Everybody has the same 10 coaches, okay? Everybody has the same number of GAs. Everybody has the same number of quality control people. How many analysts do you have? How many people do you have that are evaluating recruits? And how many people do you in the acquisition area of recruits? And how many people do you have who are on your creative side, which is designing all the material that you use to procure those recruits? I think that's what college football has become is as much about those things as it is as the front facing visible things that people identify with in terms of coaches.
Yeah. It's like a really expensive marketing firm. and then that kind of dovetails nicely with recruiting. So the two-parter here is essentially, does ASU have the first pick of the best recruits in its area, which I guess you could define as the entire state of Arizona, but you touched on earlier how important LA is, but touching on Arizona first, and then how valuable is that pool? And then generally, how is ASU thought of nationally? So you can take that in whatever order you want.
Right, so to answer your first question, the answer is no. There was a time when that was absolutely true. When I started doing this in the early to mid 2000s, the state wasn't as recruited by national programs. You guys will remember, certainly Ryan will remember, when Everson Griffin was recruited by ASU and when Devon Kennard was recruited, by USC, right? And when Devon Kennard was recruited by USC, that was when things started to change. That was when not just your Pac-12 competitors like a USC or Stanford came in and decided to recruit one or two kids a year. You started to see Michigan, Oklahoma, Texas A&M, and other national programs, Nebraska. They started to come in and spend more time. They felt like it was soft in terms of ASU's ability to keep those kids home. And they felt like there was enough talent burgeoning that they would be able to have it not be a waste of their time. And so what corresponded with that was a improvement of talent in Arizona, the expansion of the population, which was part of the housing boom before the bust in the market. So like mid to late 2000s, that really started to pick up. The number of kids doubled, probably, who were D1 in the state overall doubled, maybe a 50% increase in the number of Power Five kids. And then the state sort of became overmined in recruiting, I think, to some degree. But what happened was, where in the past, ASU was always getting half or more of the top 10 kids in the state, it started to struggle to get a few of the top 10 kids in the state. And now you look at it, last year ASU got one, I think, of the 10, depending upon like whose rankings you go by, right? And then this year ASU will get zero or one of the top 10 probably. And that's a really, really bad result. You can't, you look at around the country, there's no program in the country that is winning at the level that ASU aspires to win at that is also getting that low of a percentage of the best players from its home state to stay. And so that they know they have to reverse that. One of the things that metaphorically you've heard for the last literally four staffs has, we want to build a fence around the valley and keep the best kids here, but that hasn't really materialized. Now, I think that the facilities improvements with the stadium, lowering capacity, having a better atmosphere, closer to sellouts or sellouts for most of the games, having a facility that competes with the other best schools in the Pac-12 or even nationally, that helps change the perception of ASU in that regard. If you have a staff that's going to work and do its part. So I think they have a chance to improve in some of those areas. And I think that the state is good enough that ASU could probably, if it wanted to, if it was capable of doing so, probably taking 8 to 12 kids a year. So, you know, almost, you know, half your class, more than a third, upwards of a half of your class could theoretically be from Arizona if ASU was killing it locally. It's not a top 10 state. It's probably not a top 15 state, but it's in that probably, you know, borderline top 20 state. And there's enough players that ASU should be able to not need to do as well in some of the far-flung areas. If ASU is getting 10 kids in Arizona and ASU is getting 6, 8, 10 kids in California, well, then all of a sudden you don't need to be recruiting that much in the South or in JUCOs and, you know, the Plains or wherever the case may be.
Dave, do you want to do any more on recruiting or do you want to move on to the politics portion?
Well, I do want to touch on the national recruiting stuff because okay. So in terms of rep, in terms of like when you're talking, when ASU first contacts a kid who's, you know, in the South or out East or wherever, even in Texas, what kind of is ASU's, you know, brand to that kid? Like, is that a known commodity for a lot of these recruits or is it something that it's like a selling proposition for the school to even get them to really consider ASU? Where does it kind of stand in the makeup of national programs?
Well, that of course kind of varies depending upon, you know, kid to kid, but I would say generally speaking, there's not a great brand ID of ASU. Some recently there's some kids that have really liked ASU's uniforms and they think that maybe on TV it's a good stadium vibe and they know that the weather is good or that it's a livable place. But as far as like any real depth of knowledge about ASU's program history, you know, capability and things like that, more substantial, you know, things, I don't think there's really almost any of that with kids that are in the Eastern time zone or maybe even a lot of kids that are in Central time zone. And you know, familial connection or there's some other thing that's driving their knowledge or understanding of ASU. And that's, again, you know, dovetailing on what I was saying previously, that's why it's so important that ASU shouldn't need to be in those markets. There's a reason why almost no programs have had sustainable success when they need to recruit more than a third of their players outside of 600 miles. Oregon and Nebraska did it for a prolonged period of time. Nobody else ever has because they never ever had to. And that's why ASU shouldn't need to be relying on the Midwest or the South. You know, I understand there's a lot of talent there, but most of those kids are not going to end up at ASU. You're going to lose those battles in the end quite often, and it's not worth the resource and time investment versus what you're able to do in Southern California, Vegas, LA, and of course in Arizona, if you're executing to the degree that you probably should be.
All right, I guess we'll move on to the third point, and that's politics. So, I mean, this is maybe the most relevant because of all the recent changes at ASU, but does football have the necessary institutional support and competence from school administration? And how would you describe the factional divisions among the fan base, boosters, and insiders?
Wow. That's a pretty complex, good question.
Yeah. Hitler-Dave, he's badass. Yeah, he's a really good listener.
He's well, okay. I'm going to try to make this as succinct as I possibly can. I think that you have a president in Michael Crow and a athletic director in Ray Anderson who do aspire to have those things and want those things. But the aspirational is different from a practical. I don't know that they understand from a practical standpoint how those things manifest, like what it takes to make that happen. So that's why it's incumbent upon them to have the people who understand all of the granular detail of why and how. working underneath them. And that's where, when you add Herm Edwards, you start to lose people, because people understandably say, well, Herm Edwards doesn't have any of those things because he hasn't been coaching at all for 10 years. And he hasn't been a college coach in 30 years. And even though he grew up in California and, you know, has some sort of understanding basically of the Pac-12, you know, what does he know how to do in terms of implementing, you know, a comprehensive strategy for success, you know, the nuts and bolts of it? He doesn't, right? So that means that the other people around ASU have to be able to do those things. And Gene Boyd, who's now essentially their general manager, he's new to overseeing football. Now he you know, played the game. He's been around the Pac-12 for three decades. Those are advantages, and he's done some really good things with the student athlete development. But that's still different than what's going to happen with how you you know, evaluate and procure recruits. So what ASU is going to be doing now is they're going to be hiring people that they believe have what they need in those areas. Like, that's what they're currently in the process of doing. They're actually, I can't give names here, but like, there's a name that you guys would know, that everybody would know, actually, who follows recruiting, that ASU is probably going to hire to help them in the evaluation side of things. Like, this is a kind of a big name person, and I think it'll come out probably in a week or so. But so that's kind of what they are trying to accomplish. You know, the execution of that is obviously going to determine how successful that they are in the short and long term. And the book is still really out on that. I think there's some things that kind of look like they're setting up reasonably well. Like, for example, I think this staff that they put together, when you look at Antonio Pierce, Tony White, when you look at John Simon as a running backs coach, has done a really good job. Sean Nua, who they're bringing in to maybe help them with Polynesian recruiting, former NFL player as a defensive lineman. Like, I think that there's actually the makings of having more dynamic recruiters on the staff than they've had in the past, because usually ASU, since I've been doing this, they've had one to maybe three guys who have actually been really good recruiters. And now I think you may have the prospects shaping up where you have four or five on your staff who are actually really good recruiters, and they have a lot of roots in Southern California. Danny Gonzalez would be another one, who's their defensive coordinator. I mean, those guys did a good job at San Diego State. Tony White, Danny Gonzalez, Antonio Pierce, I think he has a unique skill set and personality and background. So that, I think, sets up well for them. Now, I think fans' expectations are, I think ASU has a lot of fans, but they have a lot of casual fans. They don't have a lot of the hardcore, really passionate fans who are in the weeds at understanding a lot of these things. Like, a lot of them have, you know, a lot of them, I would say, have just false perceptions about, you know, what ASU should be able to accomplish and how easy that is. And then there's disappointment when those things don't happen, which keep them sort of on the sidelines of being fans in a way that can even tamp down the program to some degree. Now, the fundraising efforts, I think, with their booster outreach and everything, that really improved quite a bit with the stadium project. And subsequently, so that's actually pretty strong right now. And I think that is something that could be an asset moving forward. But it's just like, it's overall, that's kind of a complex mosaic of things that we're getting into, that it's tough to really, you know, get an absolutely clear understanding of what that looks like from an outlook standpoint, you know, projecting into the future.
That was great.
Yeah. That was
phenomenal. Love it.
Chris knows his stuff.
Thanks, man.
Do you have anything else? Should we get to some of the Twitter questions real quick for him?
I think the Twitter questions are like kind of jokes. Do you see a good one? Like there's like Dave Smith's
yeah,
like
– yeah, mostly just cracks on Herm Edwards.
Yeah. I thought there were like, some real ones in there, but I must have been
there. There was one really good one, which was who will be ASU's top head coaching target for their upcoming opening?
That's pretty fun. Hey, look, so here's the thing about Herm Edwards, right? You know, I've thought about this a lot more. I've talked to a lot of people around ASU about it and everything. This is understandably looked at like, you know, almost like farcical with the college football media and people who are really hardcore into like following it. And I on one hand, I get that because, you know, we talked about it earlier, but this, you know, his profile, he didn't have a winning record as an NFL coach. He's now into his 60s. And he hasn't coached in a long time and all these kinds of things. And then he says a lot of stuff that's just kind of funny and makes it seem like he doesn't actually have a great working knowledge about things. Now, all that is kind of true on a surface level. But what I would also say is that Herm Edwards as a black, older, distinguished kind of a personality, right? In terms of how he's perceived. He has a polish from being on TV a long time. He has played, coached, been an analyst. You know, there's a lot of sort of things that even though this kind of superficial, it will probably resonate in households, you know, with parents of recruits and even with recruits themselves in a limited dosage in the right amount. I think that actually could work. And if you have really good recruiters surrounding that person who are good at some of the more granular details of a lot of these things, then that actually may yield results if you're allocating your resources correctly, which they seem to be because they are, you know, they're already showing a extreme commitment to offering 2020 and 2021 kids in the West, California and Hawaii and Arizona, et cetera, et cetera. And that's where they're spending the bulk of their time. And all that stuff. So when Ray Anderson said, we need to do a lot better in those areas and it's a talent game and we understand it's about recruiting and their facilities are better and some of those things. So and I think defensively, Danny Gonzalez is going to be calling plays for the first time, but the Rocky Long defense actually has been pretty competent when they played against better teams, Pac-12 teams. I think they've done a good job in the evaluation recruiting process down there that should actually reflect well on ASU. I think there's questions about their offense and I don't know that they have quarterback that's lined up for the next replacement of Wilkins. So there's issues there, big picture, right? I'm rambling a bit, but big picture here. ASU hasn't been really good at all in decades. Okay, they had the two, you know, anomalous years of Rose Bowls. They had back-to-back 10-win seasons when Todd Grant sort of struck lightning early on in his tenure. Other than that, it's been pretty, you know, lackluster. So what Ray Anderson is saying is, what's really the risk here? The risk is maybe that we have a couple more years that aren't that great, and we learn that maybe this was a mistake, you know, versus we do what is maybe giving us an average result by hiring somebody that's a known entity and been fired somewhere else and whatnot. And maybe that gives us 5 years of winning 7 or 8 games still. And nobody really, maybe it doesn't matter. You're just still ASU. You're the ASU that everybody's always kind of known you to be. So there's something to be said about a willingness to, you know, do like the really outside the box thing or outside the room that the box is located in thing that I talked about previously. but at the same time, it's a very risk tolerant move from the standpoint of that it may turn into where people are making a joke of it if it doesn't work out for you. And then that affects the way that you're perceived, which then causes some more lasting harm. So, I don't know, guys. I'm just going to be around covering it every day.
Right.
See what happens.
Well, it's funny because, I mean, we were hammering this from the very beginning, but, and I feel like we were early adapters of the hammering, but everyone was doing it. And then it gets to the point where, like, we got a tweet from at Condor24, Condor with a K. What's the long-term strategy in a short-term self-imposed bullpen? Like, bullpen, excuse me. I mean, just everyone's taking kind of shots like that. I think I've flipped, and I don't think Dave has, but I'm to the point where I want
I won't be flipping.
I want him to succeed.
I want it to be amazingly
successful.
I think Chris made a compelling argument, though.
Yeah, I think it's going to be, I want him, at this point, it's like you beat it up so much. I'm like, I just want to see him win and see what happens, you know, but I don't think that's going to happen, but that's kind of what I'm rooting for now.
Keep in mind, guys, you know, the most listeners of your podcast would prefer that ASU not do well, right? So that's sort of your mindset going into how you perceive it to be. And so you want to filter everything through that sort of a lens, like, oh, this is going to be a joke and here's all the reasons it's going to be bad. But guess what? Whether it's going to be bad or not is not going to be determined, for example, by how Herm Edwards does in a few radio interviews or television comments. Like that's like almost irrelevant. And yet like that's where he's getting crushed over. You know, people are crushing him about what he has to say about 2019 recruiting, or, you know, about, you know, whether he knew that the Sun Devils were the mascot of ASU or whatever. And ultimately those things are really good, but we live in this era. We live in the clickbait, you know, like the bumper sticker era where people want to use that stuff for fodder to monetize and to get, you know, likes and retweets and whatever. But ultimately those things really aren't going to have almost any impact on whether Herm Edwards actually is successful or not.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Completely agree with that.
All right. Well, I think Chris has just taken up time from Jason. So there's that rivalry there. He just wants to, like, you know.
Beautiful.
No,
yeah. Beautiful.
Jason is not as long-winded as me. No. We already know that going in.
Yeah.
He'll be good. Yeah. He'll be good, but this was you guys came to me with this thing, and these were actually really good questions that you had to give kind of longer answers to really explain the 360-degree perspective of us. So I appreciate you guys having me on, and sorry if I bored anybody.
No, not at all. That was great. I mean, Dave and I were the same way last week. It's like you start talking, and you keep talking. You're like, wow, we're talking for a long time.
Because it's complex things that everybody wants to like distill down to some like pithy little thing that you say. And that's not the reality of it. The reality of it is that all these things are extremely complex.
You also had something you wanted to plug. You got a story coming up Wednesday. Maybe you want to mention that?
Oh yeah. Yeah. So I mentioned Gene Boyd earlier in the podcast, who's basically going to be ASU's general manager of football, you know, an unofficial working title. And we have a very extended Q&A coming up with him on Wednesday and some other reporting based on that. So not just the, you know, all the signing day stuff that everybody's going to get, but people should come through and they want to understand the new leadership model from somebody who's in charge of the new leadership model. They can actually go ahead and read that Q&A with Gene Boyd.
All right.
Very cool.
Yeah. Chris Cartman does an amazing job. We always say, covering the Sun Devils, definitely, dude, you want to hang out. You want to go down and have a beer with him on Mill Ave if you're going to Tempe or something. He's a good guy for that, but obviously just brings it when it comes to Sun Devil information. Sun Devil Source does an amazing job. But Chris, thanks again for coming on and joining the show.
Ryan, Dave, great to be with you guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Chris. All right, well, that was awesome. But that was only half of the awesomeness of this podcast of champions, because now – we got Jason Shear. So he's the publisher and senior editor at WildcatAuthority.com, also part of the 24/7 Sports Network. You can follow him on Twitter at Jason Shear, S-C-H-E-E-R is how you spell his last name. And like I said, WildcatAuthority.com is where you can find all of his work. What's up, Jason, man? Thanks for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Jason, so we've got, I just went over this with Chris. We've sent you these questions ahead of time, but just again, we're talking about the structural stuff at every Pac-12 program, strengths, weaknesses of a lot of the internal stuff. And one of our listeners sent us some questions, which we will now ask you. The first section has to do with resources, basically the money associated with the school. And his question is, or questions. Does the school have the money to meet its program goals? Are its facilities adequate and modern? Does it have the financial ability to make a sudden high-quality coaching change if it wants?
Well, it's an interesting situation because I, you know, like for the last question, for instance, with the coaching change, I mean, they had to pay Rich Rodriguez $6.3 million just to hire Kevin Sumlin. And what's interesting about that is, I mean, afterwards, it was pretty much where are they going to get the money from? And they hired Kevin Sumlin on the cheap. I mean, he's making a little over $2 million. And there's an elevators and there's contract where he'll be making a pretty good amount. In a few years, figuring he does well and he sticks around. But in terms of financial resources, there's not a lot at Arizona right now. And one of the reasons is that $6 million. And also they have a lot of lawsuits going on. The athletic department is kind of a mess. But credit the current athletic director, Dave Hickey. They've kind of gone other places. Arizona was one of the few schools in the conference that didn't have a student athletic fee. They put one in last year, and so that money is going towards an indoor facility. So they're building that. They're redoing part of the stadium. So they have the money to do those certain things. I don't, you know, they don't have the money and will never have the money at, say, like in Oregon or even at USC, UCLA. But they have a decent amount. The facilities, they have the Lowell Stevens. It's a pretty nice facility. It was a lot nicer when it first came out because at this point, everything is kind of an arms race. And so while it was nice while it came out, other schools have kind of passed it by, which is why Arizona is kind of redoing the stadium and adding some other stuff. The indoor facility will finally be built. So I think maybe when you compare it on the whole, Arizona's kind of middle of the tier Pac-12. But realistically, that's probably where it should be. Also, just, you know, historically where Arizona's football program has finished. Ideally, would they have more money? Yes. Is it realistic? Probably not.
I think it's funny. Well, not funny. It's very interesting to me, Arizona known with the great basketball program. But as far as executing a coaching hire, if you look at what Arizona was able to do, you had to get rid of a coach with some controversy. And like you said, pay over $6 million. And you're able to bring in a really good hire and not spend that much money in a Kevin Sumlin. It seemed like this was executed really well. So like the last part of his question, does the school have the financial ability to make a sudden high quality coaching change if it wants? You could argue that you've already seen that over the last couple of months, and maybe not with the right resources, but just using those resources wisely, they were able to pull it off.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if someone comes in and says he wants $4 million a year, I don't think they can do it. To Arizona's credit, they did give a little money, more money to the assistant pool. So someone could bring in Noel Mazzoni, which is the guy that he wanted to bring in, and maybe a few other guys he wanted to bring in. You know, it's an interesting contract because what they did, basically what the Arizona Board of Regents did, is they made Arizona and Sumlin kind of lock in. And so Sumlin really can't go anywhere for 2 years. If he leaves after the first year, it's a $10 million buyout he's responsible for. The second year is five, and then I think it goes like 2.5 after the third. And so what they were able to do is, like, if he wins a certain amount of games, he gets like a pretty decent raise. And so, like, in 3 years, it'll go from like $2 million to $3 million. And it allows Arizona some time to kind of raise that money for the contract. But this is a coaching search that could have gone really, really poorly. And Sumlin wasn't going to happen up until it pretty much happened. I mean, it was, you know, I don't know the whole details behind the door and all that, but Sumlin was a surprise to a lot of people. I mean, it was pretty much going to be the Navy coach. And so the fact that they were able to bring in Sumlin and do so for cheap was pretty remarkable.
I was actually kind of impressed with the names that came up. It seemed like whoever was doing the evaluating, I mean, just the fact that Neil Brown was in the conversation, I think he's a really high-quality coach. Ken Nio Matalolo, whatever Khalil Tate's thoughts on the subject, I thought he would have done a fine job. I mean, maybe he would have run the option, but, I mean, he's a proven great coach at Navy. I guess the question for me is we talk about, you know, resources in terms of program goals. And I, you know, ask this of Chris and I'll ask it of you now, what are those realistic football program goals for Arizona? Like what is, you know, and their realistic, you know, scenario, what's the thing you're reaching for at Arizona in terms of consistent program goals?
You know, it's and I hope not all Arizona fans get mad at me, but I think overall what history has shown is there's some kind of unrealistic expectations with Arizona football. You know, I think ideally what everyone wants is that Rose Bowl. I mean, the fact that Arizona hasn't made a Rose Bowl is something it's reminded of every year. It's kind of Rich Rodriguez said it. Why not Arizona? He got Arizona to the Pac-12 title game. Sumlin said it at his press conference. They just want a coach to bring him to the Rose Bowl. You know, it could be one Rose Bowl in 10 years and it'd still be okay. But I think ideally the goal is just some kind of consistent improvement. And that's something like with Rich Rodriguez, that never happened. I mean, Arizona had that one good year where it lost to Oregon in the Pac-12 title game and lost in the Fiesta Bowl. And then it kind of went downhill from there. If someone can win 8-9 games a year, maybe once in a while challenge to go to a Rose Bowl, I think Arizona fans would generally be content. And I think a lot of it has to do with recruiting. I mean, Arizona hasn't had Mike Stoops recruited pretty well, but not great. Rich Rodriguez didn't recruit well at all. If someone could come in and recruit, I think Arizona fans would be fine with it. They'd be happy about it. But it's just, I think 8-9 wins with bowl wins and consistently maybe challenging for the Pac-12 South, I think Arizona fans would generally be fine. I don't think they expect to be a top 10 team every year. It's just some kind of enjoyable football to watch. And under Rich Rodriguez, it just stopped being fun to watch. And I think that's why attendance went down dramatically. And he kind of pretty much lost all support locally.
You want to move on to number two, Dave?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so this is, you mentioned recruiting, Jason. Does the school, so this is the hit for the day's question, does the school have first pick of the best recruits in the area, and how valuable is that pool, and how is the school thought of by national recruits? It was interesting to hear what Chris had to say as far as, and we're calling the local area basically like the state of Arizona. He certainly didn't feel Arizona State had the first pick. What do you think about Arizona?
No, not at all. I mean, Arizona is one of these states where it takes a major, major effort to get these kids to stay in state. And there hasn't been a coach in recent memory at ASU or Arizona that's been able to do it. And the hope for Arizona, at least, is that someone is that guy. Because when you look at someone, he's landed more top Arizona prospects than both Arizona and ASU. I mean, he was able to come into Arizona and land Christian Kirk, and Arizona and ASU they weren't really in there. Arizona definitely wasn't. And in Arizona, for instance, there are schools in Phoenix like Scottsdale Saguaro and Chandler Hamilton. Arizona can't even get in there. I mean, if there's a good prospect there, they can't get them. And maybe it changes with someone, but it's such a battle to keep these kids in state with ASU and Arizona. It's just maybe someone changes it. But even him, as good of a recruiter as he is, and he's shown, it's going to take a heck of an effort. Arizona has not been able to keep the top guys in state, and they haven't even been able to get official visits or even unofficial visits from the top guys in state. It's been a complete losing battle on that end.
So when you're projecting, so going back to those program goals, when you're talking about Arizona, you know, potentially getting to that 7, 8, 9 consistent wins per year and competing for Rose Bowl, what is that recruiting makeup of those teams? Like, what's the ideal recruiting makeup and what's the realistic recruiting makeup for a Rose Bowl Arizona team? What is their strategy? What do they have to recruit? Who do they have to recruit? Where do they have to recruit?
I think there's three places, and one of them, like Rich Rodriguez, failed in my opinion. He came to Arizona and he said basically that he wasn't going to recruit Texas because his assistants didn't have ties there. And I think if you're at Arizona, you have to recruit Texas. It's right there. There's so much talent, and like someone's come in and like I know he has Texas ties, but he's pretty much been dominating Texas in terms of offers and where his coaches have been. And like, for instance, the only assistant coach he kept from the last staff is Theron Ace, the wide receivers coach, and that's because he recruits Texas. And so it'll be Texas, it'll be Arizona, it'll be California, and maybe they'll get out there a couple other places. They have some connections in Vegas. Mazzoni has some connections in Washington, D.C. They've offered a couple guys there. But if Arizona is going to succeed, it needs to find a way to land consistently, you know, solid players from Texas, And it needs to find a way to at least land some top 10 players in the state. I mean, it hasn't even landed top 10 players in the past. And it's not going to all of a sudden start landing all of them. But maybe a few of these blue chip prospects, maybe one or two of them decide to stay home and come to Arizona. I mean, Arizona have local kids, for instance, and they signed Jamari Joyner, who's a solid quarterback. But there's a four-star offensive lineman, Mateo Malay, who didn't even look at Arizona. He literally goes to school 10 minutes from campus. And so it's guys like that that I think Arizona's going to succeed. It needs to find a way to keep them home. I mean, like 2020, there's a guy USC just offered today, Bijan Robinson, who's outstanding. And he goes, again, to high school 10 minutes away from campus. So if Arizona's going to do well, it has to find a way to keep those guys home. It has to find a way to land the Southern California talent, maybe not over USC and UCLA, but maybe over schools like Washington or Cal or Oregon or schools like that, at least compete with them for landing SoCal talent. And then Texas. I think we're going to see Texas be a major, major target for the new coaching staff. It already is. If they can go there and land some solid players, I think Arizona will be just fine in that regard.
So, Jason, it sounds like the second part of the question about how the school is thought of by national recruits, probably in a bit of a transition right now, with, you know, Kevin Sumlin having all the Texas ties and him killing it there. But, you know, maybe give your thoughts on that, not just Texas and California, but like just full on nationally, how you think Arizona is portrayed.
To me, nationally, it's probably not looked at as highly. I think there's other schools in the Pac-12 that are definitely looked higher than Arizona. It's probably looked at a middle of the road. But with that being said, there is some momentum with Kevin Sumlin. So there is some attention because Arizona's hire was so late. He was on a lot of the national programs. He was on radio, television. It was a big deal when he got hired because there were no other coaching searches. And so they've used that momentum a little bit in recruiting and offering guys and getting mentioned out there. Right now, it's probably somewhat of an afterthought in general. But I think if Sumlin wins with his connections and all that, it'll maybe raise it. They're not going to be seen with these elite programs, but I'm not sure Arizona is really thought of nationally, and maybe, you know, someone will change that. But right now, it's probably just one of those schools that's kind of just another school.
All right. Then we want to get to the third section of this, which is the politics of the program. So this is kind of a multifaceted question, and you could probably go super in depth on it. But does football have the necessary institutional support and competence from the school administration? That's the first part. And the second part, how would you describe the factional divisions among the fan base, boosters, and insiders?
If you would have asked me this question a year ago, I would have said absolutely not. Arizona's changed athletic directors and school presidents, and I think the school president was a big one. He was instrumental in landing Sumlin. Everybody likes him. Great guy, really, really into sports. He's courtside for every single Arizona basketball game, stands up, cheers, fans love him. He goes to the student section and all that. So in terms of support, they have it 100% from him, and he knows what he's doing. Arizona is kind of in an overhaul right now with all the lawsuits and all that. I think there's four lawsuits going on right now. So they're kind of cleaning house a little bit. Someone came in, for instance, and he basically, if you had any ties to Rich Rodriguez, you were gone. Basketball, they're dealing with the whole FBI scandal. There's support, but there's also the sense where if something's wrong, they're going to go out and fix it. The last president, Ann Weaver Hart, she was not well-liked at all. People are still, they just don't like her at all. They're still bitter about her. So in terms of if she was still here, I don't think she would have any support of sports and athletics or people from the outside. I think now it's a much different situation than it was a year ago, but there's a lot to clean up. And so what you're seeing is they have to sell the fans. The fans are kind of disheartened with the FBI stuff, with basketball, with Rich Rodriguez in football. Sumlin was a nice step. Boosters have been asked for a lot of money. The $6 million to buy out Rich Rod is not something that they could get easily. And so there's kind of factions, and it's kind of the deal where they want something good to happen in the athletic department, and it feels like it's been a while since that happened. And I think going forward, it may be a little harder to raise money. But if anyone can do it, it's the new athletic director and president, because they're very well liked around town.
And then I guess the second part of that, how would you describe the divisions between the fan base, the boosters, and the insiders?
It's interesting right now. I think the fan base and the boosters are pretty similar in what they want. I think everyone's kind of hesitant regarding Arizona athletics. And right now, in terms of insiders and people, it's not a lot of people are. It's kind of everybody's watching their behind, basically, because there's so much going on, so much, you know, the lawsuits, and Rich Rodriguez has a lawsuit, and there's a lawsuit with track and field, and there's a lawsuit with a running back and the domestic violence and the FBI thing. So in terms of insiders and boosters, everyone's kind of watching their back. Everyone's being really careful. I personally, I've been doing this for a while. I've never seen an AD like this, and people kind of, everyone's kind of scared to talk and scared to kind of voice their opinion more than usual. And for instance, like the Board of Regents, the head of the Board of Regents, he's making his opinion known. And he wants a thing where basically schools have to protect themselves with multi-year contracts and all that. I'm not sure we've heard from a Board of Regents since I've been covering sports here in Tucson. It's a different feeling overall with the athletic director and the whole athletic department. And it's, you know, everyone's kind of stepping around quietly and stepping on eggshells. And so it's a really interesting dynamic because it feels like it could break any moment. But it also feels like if something eventually goes right for the athletic department, it'll maybe change momentum a little bit. But I think, for instance, like the basketball thing with the FBI, it's kind of put everyone, you know, waiting to see what happens. Football, the numerous lawsuits, what's going to happen there. It's a really interesting situation because there's so much going on within different departments of the athletic department.
I know it much gets made of basketball schools, you know, being basketball schools. I was wondering, from a revenue perspective, does Arizona get more of its revenue from basketball or football?
Arizona, if you ask the basketball program what they want in terms of revenue, they said that they would tell you they need football to be better. Because at the end of the day, no matter how good basketball is, the money's coming from football. It's coming from football with attendance, apparel, everything. And so the best scenario for basketball in terms of money financially would be if football does better, because that's where the money comes from. I mean, I don't know of a lot of schools that make more money from basketball than football just because the sheer volume. I mean, even if you're looking at attendance and food sales and all that, it's just you're making more money in that regard. And even with beer, I mean, Arizona's talking about putting beer in football games, which make a ton of money. And so, you know, Arizona's known as a basketball school, but it's the football program at the end of the day that'll support everyone financially.
Yeah, I just wanted you to say it because I believe that really, really strongly about basically any school that anybody calls a basketball school besides Butler, that, they're driven by football. Kentucky is driven by football. Yeah, that SEC money is coming from football, not basketball.
100%.
Yeah. I mean, like a place like Kentucky or Kansas, like maybe it's closer, but it's still, I mean, you see the whole Big East go away. I mean, that was because of football. It wasn't because of all the basketball stuff. I don't know if you have a follow up for politics, Dave, but I thought we could, if you don't, we were going to talk about the Super Bowl, like kind of quickly. There was a, you know, really good representation from the Pac-12 and the Super Bowl led by Stanford, I think had five players in there. But if you want to look at like maybe the most important player on the Patriots, I mean, Gronk caught two touchdowns yesterday, Arizona guy. And of course the Super Bowl MVP, Nick Foles, who was a backup, like was, you know, contemplating giving up football. And now he's a Super Bowl MVP. So that can't help. That can't hurt Kevin Sublin and him on the recruiting trail when you have some prominent players like that, taking part in the Super Bowl.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say this. Arizona offered Kevin Doyle, who was a Michigan commit, a quarterback. And I think if he commits, he'd be Arizona's top guy. Arizona offered him. He visited Arizona last week. His background picture right now is Nick Foles. He changed it after last night.
Wow.
I guarantee you there's a conversation between someone and him about Nick Foles. The kid's from D.C. At the very least, it puts Arizona in the spotlight. They had Foles. Marquise Flowers is on the Patriots. Gronk's on the Patriots. The Eagles special teams coach was a coach here at Arizona and played here. It was a really cool situation in Tucson. It got a ton of attention locally, and it can't hurt. I'm sure someone's bringing that up to everybody that'll listen, every tight end and quarterback. And even though it has nothing to do with him, I'm sure he'll find a way to get that in recruiting pitch.
Michigan State also tweeted out something like Nick Foles was there for like a semester or something. And then I saw them.
Yeah, they tried to take credit for him. That was great.
That was great.
They got crushed on Twitter from what I saw.
They were deleting it, which is even better.
Oh, they deleted it?
Yeah. Yeah, they deleted it. Once they took too much heat for it, they decided that maybe they should take that tweet down.
In light of everything else going on at Michigan State, probably a good choice.
Yeah.
Just avoid any extra controversy these days, guys.
Nice. Well, that's cool. Jason, hey, we appreciate it. Did you have anything else, Dave? Or
no, that was great. Really succinct after our man Cartman, who was great, too. But that was great. We loved the breakdown.
Yeah.
Cool. I appreciate it, guys.
Yeah. Well, thanks. That's Jason Shearer. Make sure you check him out on Wildcat Authority. Jason, thanks again. And hopefully we talk to you again real soon. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Awesome, man. Well, hey, we followed up. We said we were going to do something, Dave, and we did it. So the desert schools are down. Now we got to get the mountain schools and the rest of the Pac-12 North. So 2 weeks in a row, we did what we said. So I'm proud of us.
We are suddenly a third of the way through this series. All right?
Crazy.
That's how I'm looking at it. It's great. We've got some questions to answer.
Oh, okay.
Should we answer some questions?
Yeah, we should. We should probably do that. Not as many questions as we have got before, but you know, it's the off season, so that's.
Yeah, it's understandable. The volume would decrease a little bit. All right. So first up, I'm going to ask a Twitter question, kind of a comment, but a question as well. This is from Chad Morrow at Coach Morrow OSU. One thought/question on conference discrepancy in number of league games played comparing 8 versus 9 games. What if the NCAA football changed rules to give other advantages to conferences who play 9 games? A couple thoughts would be to give all conference teams the extra month of practice bowl teams receive regardless of bowl eligibility. Another could be adding number of official visits schools can offer, give advantage to conferences that play a full schedule. I like the idea. I don't know how realistic that is from an NCAA mandated standpoint. I don't know if they can do things that are that uneven between the Power Five conferences. I would imagine there's some conference stipulations there and some contracting stuff that would make that more or less impossible. But I'd love the experiment. But I think it's incumbent on the conferences to eventually even this out. And I think it's probably more likely going to be the Pac-12 and whoever else does the 9 game caving to 8 than it is vice versa. I don't see the other conferences going up to 9.
Yeah, this kind of sounds like the coach is basically saying, we want to make everyone go to 9, so this will force them to. So you give someone a big advantage. I mean, you could say, oh, if you play 9 conference games, you get 90 scholarships instead of 85, you know, something like that. Like some of that stuff, you get an extra month of practice, you get more official visits, like, those are pretty big advantages. So I don't think, you know, Alabama's in the SEC. They only play 8. Do you think Nick Saban would stand for that where, Ohio State was going, because they have 9 conference games, they would get extra recruiting advantage against Alabama? Like, no, he's not going to stand for that. But I get what he's saying is more about, at least to me, it's more about, hey, we have to incentivize everyone to get to 9. Or, you know, like you said, maybe people go back to 8 and it's better to have 4 non-conference games. But the way it is right now, where you had some teams vying for a playoff spot that had played 10 conference games because of the conference championship, and Alabama getting in who had only played 8, that's too big of a discrepancy for me.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think one way or another, they need to all figure it out. And yeah, whether it's 8, I think 8 would be tough for Pac-12 schools, just getting a fourth non-conference team in when a lot of these schools already struggled to schedule kind of 3 because there are fewer West Coast group of 5 schools to play. So you almost have to drop down to like the Eastern Washington level, Portland State level, but maybe that's the way they'll go. I mean, it would certainly at least make things a little bit more even, the SEC in particular.
Yeah. And, you know, we'd mentioned the Super Bowl. We had a couple of tweets about it. Forrest said, are the Eagles an all-star Pac-12 team with Foles, Blunt, Aguilar, and Ertz? Only if Alshon Jeffrey went to the other USC, it would be perfect. He actually was committed to the other USC, Southern California, for like a year or something. Then he switched at the end to stay home in South Carolina. Sad Donald Trump tweeted us, Nick Foles, baby, Conference of Champions. And Dezothra, D-E-E-Z-O-T, Dezotha. How about that? They're Nick Foles and Nelson Aguilar. Hashtag Pac-12, hashtag Super Bowl 52. So, we didn't have a lot of great Pac-12 football news to report on, especially with the Bulls, but some prominent Pac-12 players, Dave, in the Super Bowls. At least gives a little pick-me-up, a little pep in our step now covering the Pac-12.
The Pac-12 doesn't seem to have any trouble producing professional football players. It's just producing college football championships where they seem to have more difficulty.
Yeah. Nice.
All right, we got some email questions.
Okay, where are we going first?
All right, this is from Alan, who is 1977 Trojan on The Peristyle. Greetings, Ryan and David. Love the podcast, and I listen regularly. I enjoyed the most recent one delving into the infrastructure of USC and UCLA. It will be interesting to hear how things are at the other Pac-12 schools for people that closely follow the respective schools. Will you be doing a show after the traditional signing day examining the recruiting classes of each Pac-12 team and how those recruits fit into their programs and their possible impacts on the upcoming season?
I think that's the plan.
Yeah.
We might have to take a break from this series to do like recruiting next week.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that makes sense. Get Huffman or Biggins on.
Yeah. Those guys, I mean, they know their stuff when it comes to West Coast recruiting. So either one of those guys, you know, we're really lucky at 24/7 Sports because we got both of those guys, or even Blair Angulo too. So I think, yeah, we definitely want to do that and kind of give a recap. And it's probably better to have a national guy on who can touch on everybody as opposed to getting super in depth on the, you know, the 25th guy that Oregon State brought in. You know, we want to get that overall view. And we'll see where everybody's ranked and stuff. We'll go through the 24/7 rankings and all that stuff. And so it should be fun.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's make a plan to do that next week, and we'll pause this thing before we get to, we'll probably do Utah and Colorado next. So start with them again the following week. You want me to read this SoCal five-star recruits who didn't go to UCLA or USC?
Yeah, where was that one? I haven't seen that one. Okay.
Oh, so this is from Go UCLA 05 from the Bro Board. So he really loved our most recent podcast. I'm going to skim this. He's a frequent poster on the Bro Board, frequent asker of questions during my mailbags. He's very good, but a little long-winded. So I'm just going to skim a little bit. So he used the rankings to – so we asked that question, how many five-star recruits from Southern California did not go to USC or UCLA? I think we framed it where it was how many went to another Pac-12 school that wasn't UCLA or USC.
Yeah, I think that's what we're talking about, yeah.
Yeah, he kind of broke it down from both perspectives. So from 2008 through 2017, Southern California produced 34 five-star recruits. Of that group, 17, so 50%, went to USC. 6 went to UCLA, so that's about 18%, somewhere in that range. And then how many left Southern California was 11. So about a third leave. But the ones who left for another Pac-12 school, so the ones who left, Wyatt Davis in 2017 left for Ohio State. Caleb Kelly in 2016 left for Oklahoma. In 2015, Blake Barnett left for Alabama. In 2013, Max Redfield left for Notre Dame. And so then in 2010, Ronald Powell and Josh Shaw both left Florida, but of course Shaw came back to USC. And then there's Darrell Scott, who went to Colorado, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, he went to Colorado, and I think Huffman still thinks that's like one of his worst evaluations ever. So because he was
and,
not,
he was not a five-star. Dane Chris, was that a Notre Dame one as well?
I believe he was, right? Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So of the ones who left SoCal, the only ones who actually signed with a current or who signed with a Pac-12 school or a Pac-10 school at that time were Vontaze Burfict and DeAnthony Thomas, and then I guess Darrell Scott if you include him. So only 3 of the 34 five-stars produced out of Southern California since 2008 ended up at other Pac-12 schools besides USC and UCLA.
Yeah, which is kind of basically what we thought, right? It was something along those lines.
But that's interesting. Okay, so cool.
Yeah. All right. I think, let's see. We have one. The Alex, the next one, Alex from Pasadena. Does that make sense?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. Sup, fellas. Sup, Alex. He must be young and hip. You think?
Mm-hmm. I think Alex, so.
He's young and hip.
Sounds like a young and hip thing to say. Sup, fellas.
First off, the last podcast was less than 2 hours. I don't feel I got my money's worth. Am I really getting what I paid for? Ha ha ha. So I'm sorry. This one's going to be closer, right? We'll be closer to 2 hours.
I think this will be close to 2 hours.
Yeah. Okay. On to my question. In regards to recruiting, I'm seeing a trend of coaches visiting these quote unquote training facilities more often, usually where a certain 7-on-7 team hold workouts in quotes. How much are these 7-on-7 clubs impacting recruiting? Are programs really taking these more seriously? I don't like the 7-on-7 circuit. Feels a lot like how AAU has ruined basketball. These are ruining football, creates a ton of bad habits. I know the recruiting sites love these tournaments and cover them, but what are your thoughts? Thanks again for the great work. Keep fighting the good fight, Alex in Pasadena. And I think there's some similarities, but I think it's still a long way off the 7-on-7 circuit to AAU. But there's tournaments like now, even before signing day, it seems like they're starting. They never really happened until spring, and now they're happening the week after signing day. You're already seeing these tournaments. As far as bad habits, I mean, I think you get some pretty good coaching out there. It's more chances to play football. I don't know. I've never really heard that argument. They're kind of teaching bad habits. I do like covering them, but even us, it's all the time. So there's so many 7-on-7 tournaments now. That circuit's so huge that you really don't even get a break. Like if you're exhausted after signing day and 3 days later, you got to go cover a tournament. Yeah. It's a little bit strange. What do you think, Dave?
I found them exhausting. It is literally every week starting after signing day, I want to say. And now it sounds like it's even starting a little bit before. So from like a reporting perspective, I mean, it'd be nice to have one of those a month, but having them every weekend, it can get a little bit much, especially when you're seeing the same guys doing the same things every single week. From the other perspective, like the AAUization, I think, yeah, in terms of the handlers and stuff, I think there's some of that going on. In the LA hotbed region, I think there's definitely some element of that. I think up until this recent FBI investigation, I think the shoe companies were getting a little bit progressively more involved, and I've seen that kind of drop off a little bit, but I still think that's an element too. But the bad habits with AAU basketball have more to do with the deprioritization of winning, as far as I'm concerned, because you're playing so many games with like different guys. You're playing like, I don't know, some of these times they're playing like 3 or 4 games in a day, and you're in these never-ending tournaments all throughout the summer and spring, and I just don't think it's, I think winning the games and playing good basketball are less of priority. But the fundamental difference with 7-on-7 is it's not really football. Like, it's elaborate passing practice. And so I think it's not necessarily, you're not playing a football game. It's not like you're going out there and like suiting up and hitting and doing everything you would do in an actual game. You're kind of just practicing your route concepts. And then, especially once they start doing the high school stuff in April and May, where they do 7-on-7 with their high school teams, they're practicing the route concepts that they're going to use later on in the year. So I think it's actually effective practice. And it's not, so much like a real game. Like AAU, it's basketball. It's just basketball in kind of a garbage format. It's kind of a different sport. So I don't know how much maybe that's kind of a weird answer, but I don't know how much it impacts like kind of the mentality of it for the players. I don't know if it like desensitizes them to losing, because it's like it'd be like if you were playing knockout or elimination or whatever you call it on weekends. I mean, is that going to change your ability to play competitively in an actual basketball game? Probably not.
Yeah.
And 7-on-7 isn't, I mean, it's just not really football. So it's like playing a different thing and practicing.
Yeah. It's like huge horse tournaments or something for basketball.
Yeah,
or something.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. It's like playing around the world. And like, you know, it's not really a, it's not, it doesn't really correlate on a one-to-one level. It's a different thing entirely.
And I think there's some definitely useful aspects, because I think there's guys that would get on that circuit and maybe they're from a smaller school. They don't get to play against good competition, and you get to see them against better competition and helps them get more scholarship offers and things like that. I'm not saying that he wouldn't get them all, you know, but it's an easier way, I guess, for some of the guys that, you know, don't have the same advantages to get noticed. Now, sometimes we get oversaturated with certain players that they just love playing. So you see, they're in every tournament every week. We get to see them all the time. Other guys are like, they're not playing all that much. So that maybe that one tournament they're playing in, we want to go see that one because, hey, this is a kid we never get to see, and we get to see them. So we get to see a lot of the same dudes kind of over and over. And I think another aspect is it's much more regional. Like, I think in Southern California, it's very prominent that there's, I think the 7-on-7 teams, the club kind of teams, the traveling teams or whatever are much more prominent. And there's still like a section, like Dave said, of the high school teams, but I think the bigger version of it is when you're with your club teams. I think in Texas, it's different. I think it's mostly high schools there. They have, I guess, a little bit more control over it there. So it's not like this national thing where everyone's doing it the same way. But I think, you know, I just haven't seen the same sort of issues. I haven't covered basketball as much, but the same sort of issues with the handlers. There's certain aspects of that. But I think it's better, I think, than basketball for sure.
Yeah, well, there's not nearly as much. I mean, well, it's not as focused, the money in football, as it is in basketball. Basketball, there's like 100 top guys that everyone's trying to get. And so the amount of money that's being paid to handlers and illicit people around them is just, it's a lot more because there's fewer guys to focus on. With football, yeah, it's a dirty sport too. I mean, like, in terms of, you know, trying to actually compensate people for their work. I know it's a shocking idea, but in terms of that, in terms of this quote unquote cheating, football is like that too. It's just, it's less concentrated and it's harder to identify guys early. Like in basketball, you know, the top guys in like ninth grade, they're probably going to end up the top guys or near the top guys in their junior or senior years, just because, you know, guys, you know, when you see a 6'6 baby faced guy, yeah, he's probably going to be 6'9, 6'10, super athletic and, you know, be a top guy. In football, you know, guys are just not developed muscularly yet. I mean, even by the time they're high school juniors or seniors, it can be hard to tell.
Yeah.
And you need a requisite amount of strength that you maybe don't need as much of in basketball. But it's just, you know, it's a little bit harder to focus on guys and, you know, pay them the really big bucks in football. So I think it contributes to the idea, if not the actuality, that it's a little bit less dirty of a sport.
And it's funny. So you mentioned that, like, you knew who LeBron James was in seventh grade. Like,
oh, for sure.
It was like, yeah, that's LeBron James. Like, you know, he's going to win the NBA championship a couple of times. You know, that you knew that in seventh grade. Who's the best, you know, you could argue Tom Brady's the best player in the NFL. And he wasn't even starting in college, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, it's very, very different.
Yeah. I mean, who are like the rare one. So with basketball, you can name any number of guys and yeah, everyone knew about them as a ninth grader, or for the most part, you know, probably 50, 60% of the guys who were really good as seniors in high school, everyone knew about them pretty early on. But if you look at football, like the ones who got identified super early, like Dylan Moses, I remember him, the running back out of Louisiana. And I think, yeah, he turned out to be an excellent prospect. So that's one. But then, who was that quarterback who ended up the tight end for West Virginia who was committed to USC? What's his name again?
Oh, crap.
David Sills.
David Sills,
David,
yeah.
Sills. He was the next big thing, and now he's not even playing quarterback for West Virginia after, you know, being, you know, top guy. And, you know, JT Daniels is a potentially a positive example because he was big-time prospect as, like, an eighth grader, and now he might start for USC next year. So, But those are, I think, the rarities. I don't think you're often seeing, you know, the easy identification of guys at, you know, the ninth grade level or eighth grade level.
Yeah, I mean, just it's like you don't have to find. It's a lot of people try to, you know, oh, that guy was a two-star. Recruiting doesn't matter. It's like, yeah, okay, that's the exception or the rule. Like, the exception would be the NBA superstar that you didn't really know much about when he was in ninth grade, you know? So,
yeah.
That's, you pretty much know. So it's definitely a different sort of sport. And with, you know, football, there's more people on the field. You're wearing a helmet. You're not, it's not like identifying a person. Most of those AAU things, you're trying to get this dude's particular dude to wear your shoes, right? Like that's kind of like the whole point.
Yeah. And you're just so, I mean, and it's a different environment. Like the evaluation, it's like a cattle call. I mean, you've got, so at the big AAU events in like April and then in July, there's just college coaches just sitting around watching the same player's game. I mean, just that focused attention, that there really isn't a situation that's like that in college football these days. Like, I guess some big high school football game that draws like a few different head coaches would probably be like the closest equivalent. But I mean, even that, I don't know that it necessarily is. I mean, I think they used to allow coaches at like some of those, like essentially the Nike camps. I think they used to do that. I could be wrong.
Yeah, I think
and that
they
would be maybe the closest equivalent. But no, there just isn't anything like it. You know, you go to, I mean, you go to try to watch whoever, whatever big time recruit. Say, you know, a few years ago, you'd go to watch Stanley Johnson, the guy who committed to Arizona, was a 5-star local. You'd go to his AAU game, and there'd be, you know, probably 5 head coaches, a bunch of different assistants from different programs, all there to watch essentially this one kid or maybe a couple other kids on his team. That just, you know, that kind of focus on a player just doesn't really happen in football. And that focus comes with, especially for the big time guys, a good deal of money.
Yeah. We've heard a lot of stories in football too, where like, how is Aaron Rodgers like discovered or whatever? Well, like they were scouting somebody else and like, hey, who's that quarterback? And I think Steven Montez was the same way out of El Paso, where they weren't really looking at him. And, you know, Colorado saw something when they were recruiting somebody else. I mean, do you think that happens ever in basketball where you're like, you know, you're there for.
Sure. With the best staffs, definitely. Like the ones who are really good at evaluating and doing their due diligence. But a lot of the coaches see that sort of like going to AAU stuff as essentially babysitting. It's not really the time to evaluate. It's the time to put in some FaceTime so that the kid sees you're there, because it is like the basketball recruits are much more diva-esque than the football guys, because again, they're getting that attention from the time they're, you know, 9th, 10th grade. And so the best coaches will spend some time evaluating other guys and watching other guys. But for the most part, they're there just to, you know, see and be seen by the player.
It's kind of funny. It's, well, I mean, that's not what we do, but when, like, if Dave and I are going to a high school football game, a lot of times it's for one dude. Like, mm-hmm. we are there basically to see one guy, and like parents might come up to you and like, hey, make sure you look at number 17. He's my son. Now he's not starting, but when he gets in there, he's going to be really good. Yeah. That's why I'm here. It's like, no.
I remember I was at a high school game one time and somebody kept asking me, oh, what's the score? Like, what just happened? I didn't see it. And I'm like, I have no idea. My camera is literally ISO'd on this one offensive lineman the yes. entire time. I can tell you how he is blocking. Would you like to know?
And they don't kind of get that. But it's funny when you mentioned the AAU games, all these people are here for that one dude. And like, there's probably some parents who are like, hey, how did you think they're fast? Like, I don't know. I'm looking at this guy. I'm only looking at him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's true for us and it's true for them. And we do it because they do it. We know who they're focused on because we know. And then we focus on them when we're, you know, filming stuff or watching stuff. And it's a never-ending cycle. And I imagine it does lead to a pretty significant fail rate where guys just go overlooked, you know, whatever, their late bloomers as juniors or whatever in basketball or football. And, oh, well, sorry. I mean, it almost happened to Russell Westbrook. I mean, he almost had to go to, I forget who the backup option was. It was some like just, I think it was like a random Midwestern school, like just some random, like might have been, I don't, it was some random D1 school, but, and it took like some real recruiting to get him to wait around for UCLA come the April signing period of senior year. So weird stuff happens. All right. We got a few more questions that we should probably knock out.
Okay.
All right. Hithloday, our man, had a little follow up to our thing from yesterday. He said, Well, you're two steps, or thing from last week. Well, you're two steps ahead of me. My plan was to trick you into gossiping at length about your own schools, mission accomplished, and then demand in the next email that in the interest of fairness, you keep it going with a series interviewing the 247 contributors. Imagine my surprise when you announced this brilliant idea to fill off-season dead air on your own. I thought the depth you went into with both schools was just perfect, and I hope it continues with all your guests. I think people who are close to something, as you boys are with USC and UCLA, tend to forget that what's obvious and not worth discussing for you is novel and unique to everybody else. My follow-up about the LA programs, both of you indicated that despite having every institutional advantage imaginable, for long stretches of the recent past, these schools held themselves back in modernizing their programs. Even if, fingers crossed, those days are over, what do you think contributed to that? The typical sins of complacency, pride, greed, and sloth? Or was there some political heavyweight holding things back? I can start if you want.
Sure, go ahead.
Think about it.
Yeah.
I think, so those sins of complacency, I would say pride and sloth were the main issues at UCLA since basically John Wooden retired in 1975. I think so. Here's my timeline, my people's history of UCLA. I think UCLA got very lucky in hiring a super elite basketball coach at a time when UCLA was still forming an identity. I think that was, what, 1949, 48 when Wooden was hired. And they hired this guy who was, you know, a relative unknown, but people kind of saw that he was going to be a pretty good coach, and then he turned into a super elite guy. And that established UCLA's athletic brand. I think UCLA would have ended up probably a pretty good athletic school regardless, because LA is a great place to recruit to, as I'm sure my co-host knows. But wouldn't put UCLA on the map as the elite athletic institution on the West Coast for a time, in terms of all the different sports, the gamut of everything. Obviously, basketball became a big national thing in some part due to those UCLA teams. But after that happened, UCLA, I think, behaved institutionally as if that happened because they were UCLA, not because it was just kind of a happy accident that they ended up hiring this guy. And so they tried to go on the cheap and tried to treat UCLA as if it's the job that everybody should want. And so they don't have to pay market price for coaches, and they don't have to, you know, do these, you know, crazy due diligence things to get coaches, like, you know, actually evaluating the coaching landscape when they're hiring. And instead, oh, we can just hire internally because we're UCLA. We'll just be good because we'll be good. And I think it was just this kind of lazy, prideful thinking that led UCLA to make just a lot of, you know, mediocre to bad basketball hires, a lot of mediocre to bad football hires, to maintain as like their standard for excellence Terry Donahue, who I think over the course of his career averaged like 7.6 wins a season, and then to hire first his subordinate, offensive coordinator Bob Toledo, and then Carl Durrell, one of his former players, and then Rick Neuheisel, one of his former players. I think there was this idea that, you know, coaches needed to be part of the UCLA family to be hired there. And I think it was just a lot of lazy, incestuous thinking going on there. I think the institution as a whole just needed a change up. I think they got it a little bit with Jim Mora. I think they've gotten it a little bit with some changes in the athletic department, in terms of how they do their fundraising, in terms of just, you know, the buy-in from different factors internally, from the booster group. But I think it's, you know, I think Mora has a lot to do with it. And now the proof that they're really turning over a new leaf is hiring Chip Kelly. And whether that works out or not, I think, you know, institutionally, it's, I don't think UCLA has ever been as obviously committed to being good on the football field as they are by hiring Chip Kelly. Whether it turns out well or not, I think the buy-in is finally there.
Great stuff. And I think there's some similar aspects of like the prideful stuff and the sort of sitting on your laurels at USC as well. I mean, for basketball, they've just always seemed to be a snake bitten program for whatever reason. I think when USC basketball was at its best, It was during a time when only one team from a conference could make the NCAA tournament. So you happen to be in like this all-time dynasty right next to you. And I think there was one team that USC that lost like 24-2, but didn't make the NCAA tournament because they lost to UCLA or something. So, and then every 5-8 years, they'll make a little run and something weird goes on. I think when I was in school, they had, who was Baby Jordan? Why am I blanking on his name? But they had a really good team and like Georgia Tech hit a jump shot at the end, like a long jump shot, like, you know, with point something seconds left and beat USC. There's always just to be seen stuff like that. This was a year where everyone thought USC was going to be great. And then the FBI stuff that Jason Shearer's mentioned, it happens. It kind of derails them. They just never seem to be able to get over. I don't know. There's always something seems to go wrong whenever you think that they're going to be, Harold Miner was his name. Man, I couldn't believe I blanked on that. So that's on the basketball side. I think they've tried. It just seems to be really not in the cards. And I think they've been able to build like some popularity, you know, from the football team. The football team's had a long tradition. So there's teams that had great traditions like in the 30s. I mean, you've seen, you know, like Yale or, well, you know, these, a lot of these schools, they don't, you know, play real football anymore. It's rare when you have a school that can win in, you know, those kind of decades and 60s and 70s or whatever. And then, you know, they go for a little bit of a break and, you know, later on, USC started winning Heisman. So you got championships, you got Heismans. And they didn't really have the recent relevance until Pete Carroll came along. Like they were, you know, they'd go to Rose Bowl every once in a while or whatever, but it just wasn't the same sort of thing. Pete Carroll changed that. And like, just like Dave said with, John Wooden, I mean, they kind of lucked into that one, really not their first choice, but you know, looking back, he was a guy that was a, you know, great NFL mind, really had the energy to be a college coach and this kind of rah-rah guy who maybe didn't go all that well in the NFL, but it was seemed to be his game seemed to be suited perfectly for college football. And he didn't have to do it in a way like a Nick Saban where it's just a scowl all the time and everything's business. Now, Pete Carroll, I mean, he can be a real jerk. I mean, it's not like he's a pushover. He's a really competitive guy, but he'll do everything in a more gregarious way, and it just seemed to fit in Los Angeles. So that kind of worked. And you know, you can build some success off that. So you get more All-Americans, more Heismans, championships. You kind of add to that legacy. And there's it just goes in cycles and it goes up and down. I think since then too, you try to hire in sort of a same lazy way. And sometimes it works out, but a lot of times it doesn't. And I think there is some of that pride there where, okay, now you built yourself back up to near the top of the mountain. Go out and make that big hire. Do what UCLA did and hire a Chip Kelly. And we just haven't seen USC do that. And I think I talked about this last week. Some of it has to do with you have a coach like that. They end up running a lot of what's going on. I mean, do you know who the president of Alabama is or the athletic director? It doesn't matter because whatever Nick Saban says goes. You get a Pete Carroll, you get a guy like that. They're running things. And sometimes the administration doesn't want someone like that. They'd like to win, but we don't really want someone wielding all that kind of power too. So I think a lot of that's kind of internal where maybe that's not prideful. Maybe that's just being selfish and they would rather keep their little fiefdoms moving the same way as opposed to bringing someone that was going to shake everything up. But there's certainly a lot of built-in advantages. And even, you know, if you ask David Woods where Clay Helton would be ranked as far as Pac-12 coaches go, he's probably not going to put him very high. But he won a freaking Rose Bowl and he won the Pac-12 last year. So just being like a competent coach at USC, I think can get you pretty far because of all those built-in advantages that you had talked about.
I think the Clay Helton-Jake Browning combo would be the top 80th combination in the Pac-12. I think he's about 8th best, and that's I think a testament to the built-in advantages at USC that the 8th best coach in the league can win the conference with relative ease. All right, we got one final question from Anthony.
Okay.
Hi, Ryan and Dave. What is more surprising? UCLA has only one basketball national championship since 1975, or the last Pac-12 national championship in basketball was Arizona in 1997.
Huh. Good. I mean, I don't know. Do you have a thought on this? So I mean, UCLA won in 95, right?
I would say surprising isn't the word because I knew both of those, so it's not surprising to me. I would say the which is the more distressing or which is the more like of an issue. I mean, probably the lack of a Pac-12 national championship. I mean, UCLA has made so many bad coaching hires since 1975 that it's like, okay, well, that makes sense. But the lack of a Pac-12 national championship, I think, speaks to the kind of the way the league is just in both football and basketball, been kind of, you know, rendered a little bit secondary to the national conversation in a lot of ways.
Well, I'd say, so UCLA won in 95, right? Tyus Edney and all that stuff. So and then Arizona in 97. So that was a pretty good run for the Pac-12. And that was like, I think Arizona was the first team to ever beat like three number one seeds when they won. So that's a pretty amazing run. But yeah, we just haven't seen them really even be all that competitive. You would see like, you know, two Big Ten teams making the Final Four and stuff. And it just wasn't the same. Like UCLA had a few Final Fours there, but they just didn't seem to be, they were just kind of like to get there. It wasn't like, it didn't seem like a team that was built to win.
I mean, they lost by double digits in each of those Final Fours under Ben Howland.
So
they lost twice to Florida by double digits and then once to Memphis.
Yeah. I think it's, I mean, it's disturbing that they really have it. And it's not, I mean, I would say, yeah, winning is great, but just they don't really seem to have teams that look like, okay, this is a team that's going to make a run and go a long way. The good teams seem to get upset pretty early a lot of times in the tournament. I don't know what it is, but that's, it should be better. I think Pac-12 basketball should be better. And I mean, like we said, I don't watch as much of it anymore. I watch some, but just it's not been the same to me. And maybe that's part of it. I definitely during those times, like the in the 90s, I watched a hell of a lot more college basketball than I do now. But I don't know. It's hard for me to put my finger on exactly what it is, but it's, you know, it's a problem. I don't know why, you know, what Arizona went up and lost to Washington the other day. You know, ASU is like the talk of the conference in the, you know, in, out of conference schedule. And now they, you know, they're under 500 in conference. It's just weird. It's just, it's, something doesn't seem to click, Dave. And it's not, you don't have like this Duke or North Carolina, like they're just make these runs and they're all powerful, Kentucky or whatever. It just doesn't seem we've had that in the Pac-12 for many, many years.
Yeah, I think that's all true. I think UCLA had a nice run under Howland. Those three Final Four teams.
That's a great run.
I could record for 7 hours about the 2008 team and why Ben Howland was the reason they lost to Memphis, but I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to subject all of our listeners to that. Aside from that run, I mean, Arizona has had some good stretches, but I think the fundamental issue is a lack of elite coaching in the league. I mean, I would say right now, Arizona has a pretty good coach in Sean Miller, but I think he's, I don't know if I would call him super elite. I think he's a really good recruiter, and I think he's a fine to good in-game coach, but I don't know that he's got what it takes to get Arizona back to being a legit national championship team. I know Steve Alford does not at UCLA. At USC, I don't think Andy Enfield's that guy. I mean, I would say the best like peer coaches in the league are probably what? Dana Altman at Oregon, and maybe Larry Christakoviak at Utah. Utah's never going to get the talent to do it. And at Oregon, maybe Dana Altman gets it, gets the right combo. I think last year he had close to it, but I don't know. It's just, I think when UCLA is relatively down as it has been for the last 10 years or so. And when Arizona is, you know, pretty good, but I think the league needs two kind of poles that are both in that elite conversation, and UCLA has just been out of it too much. When UCLA isn't, it's like when USC is not really great at football, the league's not doing a whole lot. When UCLA is not great at basketball, the league also doesn't do a whole lot.
Yeah. Man, I can't believe we talked that much about basketball.
I know. We got to stop. We got to stop right now.
What is it? So that's 11 national championships for UCLA, right?
Mm-hmm.
11. Yeah. Because I remember
10 in 12 years and then one in 42, 43 going to be this year.
Yeah. I remember when my first engineering job, I was working at Hughes Aircraft Company in El Segundo, and one of the guys in our, like, we had like cubes and there, one of them was a big UCLA fan. So he had the, I remember in 95, he had it hanging down there, and he would talk about Banner 12 all the time. Like it was this next thing. Like Banner 12 was like big talk and stuff. And, I mean, Howland had shots, you know, you go to three Final Fours, you at least got a shot. So that was a pretty good run, but just it seemed like those are kind of few and far between for the Pac-12 for some reason.
Agreed.
All right. Well, hey, good stuff. We got hour 45 ish. So that's not too bad.
Hopefully the people who pay us the big bucks for this feel satisfied now.
Yeah. Get your money's worth. Where should they send checks, by the way? We need Venmo or something. Send us a few bitcoins. I don't know. Whatever you want.
Yeah. A few. They're worth nothing these days. Only like $6,000-$7,000 a piece.
Is it really? Is it that high? That's tough.
Yeah. That fake money is still kicking ass.
There was one that was like totally fake that just went under. It was like a vegan, like cryptocurrency or something. So it like appealed to people like that. And, it just went away. So it's like, that's what I would worry about, the cryptocurrencies. It was just like, oh, it's just gone. It's like somebody's like computer. It's like on a drive somewhere. He just erases it and that's all gone. I don't know much about this stuff, but okay.
Yeah, it's something with blockchain, and you have a big computer that solves math problems or something, and I don't know, you make money. It's fake money. Yeah. It's fake money. It should be worthless. I heard this story today about somebody who paid for Bitcoin when it was at 19,000 with her $20,000 limit credit card, maxed it out basically to buy it, and now it's down to 6,000. And it's like, how many people are spending fake money credit to buy fake money? Like, it's just, what are we doing? It's
that person,
not to go all, you know, 1960s philosopher on everybody, but my God, everybody.
That's bad. You're going to find out what 19%, you know, interest.
Yeah.
That's going to sting.
Oh, it's baffling.
You know what? It's funny. And we're way off topic, but I was looking back at my bookshelf before we did the show. There's a book by David Chilton called The Wealthy Barber. Everybody's Common Sense Guide to Becoming Financially Independent. So if you're thinking about buying Bitcoin on a credit card, is it 19,000? Go read this. Go read The Wealthy Barber. I recommend it. And it will help you, I think. Have you read this one, Dave? Or
just steal it if you don't have the money to buy the book.
Use your...
Well, it's the old... I think it's the Abby Hoffman, like, anarchist guide from the 60s that's... It's literally called Steal This Book, and you're just supposed to steal it, and it's all, like, basically, how do you live without money? And it's just all the things you can steal and beg for. That's a book. And that's a book everybody should read.
I need to check that one out. That's like survival skills. I like that.
Never read it. I'm sure it's full of a lot of really relevant information from 60 years ago.
They need an updated version. They need a 2018 version.
Yeah, they need to update that. Steal This Book, Volume 2.
Because you could do so much with just, you know, with your phone or whatever. Like, you can, you know, you don't have to physically steal stuff. You can electronically steal stuff. So, you know, if you can hack into things or whatever, get credit, blah, blah, blah. I mean, there's...
That sounds hard. On second thought, let's just buy some fake stuff. Let's buy some fake money.
I love the credit card. Oh, my God. So bad. So bad. All right. Well, I guess we should wrap it up.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah. David Woods. I'm Ryan Abraham. We are the Podcast of Champions. For some reason, you listen to our show, and we do appreciate it. Whatever reason compelled you to turn this on and listen, we hope we haven't changed your mind about doing it in the future. We will do a signing day show next week. So post-signing day kind of analysis with one of the analysts from 24/7 Sports, and then we'll get back to our in-depth analysis of all the programs in pairs. So like David said, probably the mountain schools in 2 weeks. So if you have any questions about Utah or Colorado or about signing day, send those in, Pac-12podcast@gmail.com or tweet us at Pac-12podcast. And we'd love to answer those on the show. So signing off for Dave and Ryan, thanks so much for tuning in, and we will talk to you next time.